discuss the verses from the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is describing stages, from the stage of perfection, stages of bhakti going down like steps, or reverse, going up to the perfection of yoga system. So that's the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Systems of yoga, first before that, towards the end of the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is describing different principles, just like he is in chapter 6 and chapter 12. In chapter 6, because it's a summary verse, let me step back. The Bhagavad Gita is divided into thirds. 6, 6, and 6 makes 18 chapters. So the first 6 chapters of Bhagavad Gita, there's a strong emphasis on Karma Yoga, or Karma Palatyag, or working without attachment to the fruits of work. Karma Nivedikara Slema Paleshu Kadachana. Working without attachment to the results of work, but working. Working as obligated indicates inequality of goodness. It's a feature of goodness when people do things because they ought to be done. They ought to be done. They should be done. And so I do them. Like, be truthful. Why should you be truthful? Because you should be, it's a quality to live by. It's the feature of the quality of goodness, that one is truthful, one is clean, one is straightforward and honest in their dealings, they're compassionate. We can say, you know, there's ethical, why are those ethical reasons? Why are they standard throughout all of society, any culture, any language, any part of the world? They're the features of goodness according to the conception of Bhagavad Gita. That means one should refrain from passion, which is attachment to the fruits of work, and ignorance, which is ceasing to perform work, laziness, sleep, lethargy, indolence, and so forth. One shouldn't be neglectful of work, and one shouldn't be working for results, which will work, because work in a religious way, because it's to be done. You know, like a parent training their child, saying, you should clean your room. Why should I clean my room? Because mommy said so, you should clean your room. Well, you know, okay. But why does mommy say so? Because it's a cleanliness is a principle of godliness. Cleanliness is next to godliness. One should be clean. It's a quality of goodness. So forth. So, that those first 6 chapters are emphasizing karma yoga, or working with detachment. What's the fruit of working in detachment? The fruit of working in detachment is that the capacity of the soul to be illumined, to be enlightened, has just increased, because the covering of passion has been reduced. Goodness has become increased, so knowledge becomes more prominent. From Karma Yoga comes then Gyan in chapter 4 of Bhagavad Gita, transcendental knowledge about Krishna. And then chapter 5, working with detachment together with transcendental knowledge of Krishna. Action in Krishna consciousness. And as that fixing of the attention upon the Supreme becomes even more concentrated, it becomes dhyan, becomes meditation. So dhyan yoga is the chapter of, the topic of chapter 6. So, Krishna describes, by virtue of divine consciousness in one's previous life, one automatically becomes attracted by the yogic principles, even without seeking them. Which is very nice. Means if we don't complete our path, our spiritual path in this life, we'll become naturally attracted proportionate to the advancement we made on the spiritual path in our previous life. There's no loss. It's a permanent spiritual asset. When I was a college student, I never heard, up until that time, never heard the syllables, Krishna. If you can imagine, because you were born in India, it's like unthinkable, but I was 20, before I heard Krishna. And I was at once attracted. I didn't know what Krishna meant or Krishna was. I was attracted. If there was somebody that was traveling around in the university circuit and teaching, chanting Hare Krishna, I was attracted. And so they gave me a Bhagavad Gita. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was poetry, because I was into poetry. So I thought somebody was giving a poetry book. I was very attracted. I realized it wasn't just poetry. It was far deeper than that. Anyway, from previous life, one becomes, with Krishna's words, naturally attracted to yogic principles. Such an inquisitive transcendentalist stands above the ritualistic principles in the scriptures. What are the ritualistic principles in the scriptures? The Karma Kanda section of the Vedas, the performance of sacrifices or yajnas in order to achieve something material. Health, wealth, pass your exams, something. Start a business, do well, something. The rituals for, you know, good marriage for my son, daughter, and something. So, rituals. That's good. But standing above that is linking with the Supreme principles. Then Krishna says, and when the yogi engages himself with sincere endeavor in making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, then ultimately, achieving perfection, after many, many births of practice, he attains the supreme goal. So then he gives this sequence. This is text 46 of chapter 6. A yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruitive worker. And we're going to hear this list again in chapter 12. The ascetic, or tapasvi, restraining the senses. Greater than the empiricist, the intellectual, who speculates on the nature of higher reality or the supreme. Greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, greater than the fruitive worker, even the religiously enjoined types of fruitive work, the sacrifices enjoined in the Vedas for improving fruitive gain. Look, this is Krishna's words, it's not our opinion, it's Krishna's statement. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. Okay, so that's clear. Now there's different types of yogas. And so then the final verse of chapter 6, of all yogis, the uttama form of yoga, the topmost form of yoga, is shadhavan bhajate yomam. With faith, shadhavan bhajate, engaging in my devotional service. Bhaj is the root word for bhakti. From bhaj comes bhakti. Bhajate yomam, specifically devotional service unto Krishna. Same yukta uttama mataha. Mataha means, it is my opinion. And when we say it's my opinion, it's not really worth so much. But when Krishna says it's my opinion, it means it's a fact. It's just a very polite way of saying it's a fact. It's a fact that of all different systems within the Vedas, the yogi is the best. And of all the systems of yogi, yoga, a bhakta yogi, abiding with me in faith, is best, is topmost, uttama. So then the next six chapters is describing that. What is this uttama form of yoga? What is this Shraddhavan Bhajate Yomam? The beginning verse of the seventh chapter, Krishna says, I'm going to explain how you do it. That's what he says. It's the how-to section. First was what, then how-to. And that how-to section ends with chapter 12. So 6, 6, and 6 makes 18. It's 18 chapters. And the second six ends with chapter 12. And chapter 12 is entitled Devotional Service or Bhakti Yoga. So connecting it with the first six chapters and then the flow how-to. So now he's in its 12th chapter. Krishna is going to describe the stages or the stages of perfection of bhakti. Because now going back, in chapters 7 and in chapter 9, Krishna has described what is unmixed and what is mixed devotion. Because real devotion is not mixed. It's like milk. I learned this. As far as I know, it doesn't happen in America, but it happens in India. When you buy milk, it's mixed. It's mixed with water, or it's mixed with buffalo milk and cow milk. Then put a little plastic bag, and here you go, here's some cow's milk. And you ask, is it pure cow's milk? And they'll say, I always say yes, pure cow's milk. And you know it's not, because just is how they do business. So that cow's milk is cow's milk. It's not cow's milk mixed with water or buffalo milk. Or pure gold or whatever, something. Pure ghee. Or, you know, a bag of rice. How many stones does it have in it? You know, because you're from India. And they say, no stones. And you open up the bag and count how many stones and say, you know, you're not an honest merchant. That happened in Mayapur. We had, they ran out of rice in Mayapur, you know, during festival time. So I was with Jagannath Maharaj and he was asking, how come we ran out of rice? And they said, well, one of the merchants, he gave us bags. We grow most of our rice in Mayapur, but we at festival time, we can't grow enough for all the devotees. So we tried to get the honest merchants, and unfortunately, the honest merchant got a shipment that had rocks in it. So they ran out of rice. Anyway, bag of rice means without rocks. And bhakti means without mixture. So chapter 9 specifically describes devotion that's mixed and devotion that's unmixed. So real devotional service is unmixed. That's chapter 9. Chapter 10 is Krishna continues to describe about himself that he not only he is the object of devotion, but listen to this, Arjuna, something that even the great sages, the demigods, the most learned persons don't know. And that is, what's the source of everything? And it's not possible to know the source of everything unless it's disclosed. It's very logical. What existed before we existed? You don't know. You can't go back in a time machine. You can write a science fiction book about it. Jules Verne wrote a science fiction about a time machine. You go back in time. What existed before we existed? But we don't really know. Unless that which existed before you existed discloses. Even history books, they're written by people that, you know, have their own slant on things. So where did everything come from? You don't know, unless there's disclosure. Krishna said, I'm not going to disclose it to you. I'm the source of everything. And when Krishna hears that, or Arjuna hears that, I'm summarizing. There's many things that are said, but Arjuna has this realization. You're the Supreme. You're the Supreme Abode, you're the Supreme Purifier, you're the Supreme Cause of all causes. You're the Absolute Truth, you're my friend. But you're not just my friend, you're the Absolute Truth. Now I understand. And so that I can always think of you, can you describe the various ways in which I can always think of you? So he describes, Krishna describes his vibhutis. Chapter 10, it's called Vibhuti Yoga. His opulences in this world. So as we look around, we see the sun, we see flowers, springtime, we see fish, we can think of all fish, I'm the shark, of all mountains, I'm the Himalayas. I was just, before coming here, I was in the Canadian Rockies. It's beautiful. The scenery is fantastic. You have to think of God. It's just awesome. But that's, you know, of all of mountains, I'm Mount Meru. Of immovable objects. And so forth. Of horses, I am Uchaishrava. And so on. So Krishna is the greatest of all. He's the opulent. Of all things that are opulent, the most opulent, that's Krishna. But if that opulence is but a vibhuti. It's but a spark of his splendor. And with just one fragment of myself, I pervade and support the whole cosmic manifestation. That's chapter 10. In chapter 11, Arjuna says, can you show me that form of yours by which the entire cosmic manifestation can be seen at one time? Your Virat Roop? And he already knows, he's stated it, that Krishna is the personality of God. So it's not he's doubting Krishna, but our acharyas describe it so that Arjuna is asking this so that later on, somebody comes along and says, I'm God. Then you can say, oh, can you show me your universal form? If not, I can't accept that you're God. Because anybody can say those words. I'm not a college student at Bard University or Bard College and said, I'm God. So I said, can you show me your universal form, please? He said, I can't do that. I said, okay, well, I don't accept that you're God. He didn't know what to say. So I said, you're reading too many books. You know, humility and be humble. So Krishna shows his universal form. And it's spectacular, so spectacular that Arjuna finds it fearful. And describes the whole thing and says, Krishna, please take that form away and show your original form. Krishna withdraws the universal form, shows his Chaturbhuja, his four-arm form, then he shows his two-arm form. Then he says, it's only one who is my devotee, only by devotional service can one see me as I am, standing before you with this original form. So that's the lead-in for chapter 12, which is our topic. Chapter 12, Arjuna asks an important question. And Krishna gives a really direct answer. There's no unclarity about it. Arjuna's question is, which is recommended by you? Which form of yours should I worship? Should I worship the impersonal or should I worship the personal form? Really clear question. Krishna gives a really clear answer. Worship my personal form. That's best. Then he describes why it's best. Not just clean your room. But why worship the personal form? And he gives three primary answers, more than three, but primary answers are, it's my form. It's natural. And the second reason is that for those who are embodied, and that's most of us, there may be some spirits and ghosts floating around, but for the rest of us, we're embodied. For those who are embodied, to fix the mind on that which has no form, that which has no qualities, that which has no name, that which is all-pervading, that which is indistinguishable by any kind of material feature, to fix the mind on that is very difficult. It's like fixing your mind on infinity. How do you do that? No form, no quality. So you have this, sign. Infinity. But, that's cheating because infinity really has no sign. Linga. It has no form, no quality, no name, no feature, no activities. How do you do that? So Krishna says it's very difficult. It's unnatural, in other words. One is natural, the other is unnatural. And the third reason is, in the process of fixing one's mind on the form of the Lord, the Krishna factor comes. That is, Krishna delivers one to the spiritual position. But if you're not depending upon Krishna, the person, good luck. It's just you against impossible. But with the devotional process, Krishna uplifts one. Krishna picks one out of the ocean of material existence and places one as one of his eternal associates. It's like a small child. A small child is dependent. But with the assistance of a mother and father, it's much easier to be a child. But we're dependent. Without the person, the master, Krishna, it's very difficult. But it's very easy with the assistance of Krishna to achieve that stage of linking with him, worshipping him, worshipping his personal form. So now that's all background. Now comes these stages. So we're discussing chapter 12, verses starting in text 8. So Krishna starts, you can have, if you like, an image of a staircase. So he's speaking of the top stair or ladder, the top rung of the ladder, either way you like it. Good, so it's a descending order from the topmost stage. So the topmost stage is, Krishna says, just fix your, two things, very simple. Just fix your mind upon me. That's one thing. And engage all your intelligence in me. That's the second thing. That's the requirement. That's the litmus test. That's what you need to do. And the reciprocation from Krishna's side is, by so doing, you are with me always, without a doubt. So that's the perfection. Just like he says at the end of chapter 9, Vandana Bhavamad Bhakto. So this is the same standard. Mind always engaged in me, intelligence always fixed upon me. Show me you live in me always, without a doubt. So we're going to go down, we'll come back up again. Some person may say, oh, that's very nice, but I can't do that. Always my mind fixed upon Krishna, intelligence always in his service. Well, what alternative do I have? Krishna says, if you can't do that, if you can't fix your mind in that consciousness or that state, then you can follow the regulations of bhakti yoga. For by following the regulations of bhakti yoga, it will awaken within you the desire to come to that stage. Okay. So I'm not at this stage of perfection, but I can follow a path that will lead to the perfection. And for some persons, the regulations of bhakti yoga are not so difficult. But somebody may say, oh, I can't do that. Follow the regulations of bhakti yoga, it's too much. What about me? So now Krishna goes down another step on the staircase or rung on the ladder and says, if you cannot follow the regulations of bhakti, then try to work for me. Karma yoga. Just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect state. That is to say, by working for Krishna, it's some attraction for Krishna. Not just attraction for work, but attraction for the object, Krishna. So that one becomes inspired, let me try to follow these regulations of bhakti. Because by following the regulations of bhakti, I'll develop the desire to come to this perfect stage. So, but we're already down on the third step, just working for Krishna. What does working for Krishna mean? What's an example of working for Krishna? At our center in New Jersey, I was there one Sunday ago. And just before the Sunday program, one man came. He's driving up the driveway in his work van. And there's a whole bunch of, the back of the work van was open. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the back. And I wonder what's going on. It's a man that's just, he likes to take care of the landscape of the temple. He got out all of his mowing equipment and those, you know, the machines that cuts all the stuff that a lawnmower doesn't get. And he went out into the garden and was, you know, pulling weeds out of the garden, the hose, and just a nice man. He just liked to do it. The temple didn't hire him. He just wanted to work for Krishna. And I asked him if he chants. I had never met the man before. I asked him if he chants. He said, I'd like to come to class. Don't chant much. Bhakti Prasadam. Okay. That's an example. Somebody that likes to do, so let's say you go to one of our temples, say at Rathiyatra. This coming weekend is Rathiyatra in Los Angeles, so thousands of people will come. And some people, you know, can I help? Okay, you can serve out the puris. You can serve out the potato salad. Okay, I'll serve out. But you gotta be clean, you gotta wear gloves and, okay. And they're serving out prasadam. They're like, doing some service for Krishna. Can you help set up the tents? Can you help break down the tents? Because it takes a lot of people. Sure, I'll help. Karma Yoga, work for Krishna. Clean the temple. Do something. So somebody may say, oh, I can't do that. That's too difficult. I can't work in that consciousness, work for Krishna. What should I do? So Krishna gives the next step down. If, however, you're unable to work in this consciousness of me, then try giving up all the results of your work and try to be self-situated. So be charitable. Find some good cause and give something to a good cause. And while that detachment from the fruits of work is there, reflect upon the nature of the eternal soul. Just think about it. Try to become situated in Sat while detached from Asat. Try. So that's what a lot of in the world what's called religion today is doing some charitable work and some kind of prayer where there's calling upon the Supreme and some idea like that. And you think of what's beyond the temporary. Somebody may say, oh, I can't do that, that's too difficult. Krishna is very merciful. So he takes one down one more step. Says, if you cannot practice like that, if you cannot take to this practice, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge. That doesn't mean just, you know, enroll in a university. It means knowledge of the scripture. Study the scripture. What would be the purpose of studying the scripture? To understand what is dharma, what's proper behavior, proper conduct, theistic conduct. And through knowledge, try to understand the difference between temporary and permanent. Because previously Krishna said, become situated in what's permanent. Then, beyond that is trying to understand what it is. Like second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Try to understand the difference between matter and spirit by discerning the difference through the guiding direction that comes from scripture. Now he starts going back up again. Better than knowledge, however, is meditation. Not only when you're trying to figure it out, but you're fixing your mind on that which is eternal, as opposed to that which is temporary. You're directing your mind with discerning intelligence towards that which is eternal. Now this is very nice. Listen to this. And better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action. Working for Krishna. Because when you're renouncing the fruits of action, where do you go? You have to go somewhere. It's not just a matter of, you know, go to work, get a paycheck, cash your check, and then leave the money on the street and then walk away. Detachment from the fruits of your work. Detachment means reposing those fruits in the proper place. Until the brahmanas or the vice Sadhus, those that are doing the work of the Supreme, or the worship of the deity, like that. Or the propagation of spiritual knowledge, the Brahmanas, and the Vaishnavas. For by such renunciation, one can attain peace of mind. An example of this is King Rantidev. You know the story of King Rantidev? Very quickly I'll narrate. King Rantidev is described in the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam. He's in the lineage of kings, predecessor of the Yadu dynasty. So it's in the Yadu Vamsa. And he was a great king and he was a great devotee. And he was so advanced in devotion that he, not theoretically, but he literally saw the spiritual equality of all living beings. Like the verses in Bhagavad Gita, Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hastani Shuna Chaiva Sapakicha Pandita Samadarshana. Pandita Samadarshana. He sees all living entities equal. What's the basis of seeing all living entities equally? It's not their covering, because coverings are different. They're spiritually equal. One sees equally the learned, the Brahmin, the Gavi, the elephant, the dog, the dog eater, because they're all, the covenants are different, but the spirit soul is of equal value. So King Rantidev was on that platform. He saw the soul as being equal, although the coverings are different, and within the soul is the Supreme. He's the king. So he's on the big seat. He's in the royal throne with all royal opulence. But his vision was that of a tattvadarshi. So he was known to be very charitable. He would regularly, because he saw, not just because it's the religious thing to do, but he saw the spiritual equality of all beings. He was a very charitable king. And because he was so spiritually elevated like that, and so charitable, he was loved by everybody. They were happy to be under King Rantidev. So one time, he underwent an extended fast. Have any of you fasted sometimes on Janmashtami Day? So you know what that's like, fasting on Janmashtami Day, or some special occasion. At the end of the day, you're tired from fasting. Rantidev's fast was for 48 days. It was nirjal. No water and no food for 48 days. You can imagine how weak he was at the end of that. Of course, you know, he was accustomed to austerity, so it was easier than... We would die if we fasted for 48 days. We wouldn't fast for 48 days. But he had that capacity. And on the day, the 49th morning, he was to break his fast. It was all arranged by the Brahmanas, so the auspicious, everything, the timings to do everything. And so it was a royal feast that he was going to break the fast with. Cooked in ghee and very opulent, very, very nice. And a whole ceremony was arranged, and he sat down to break his fast after the 48-day fast. And just as he was about to break the fast, one Brahmin came, right into the assembly. Because he's king and he has respect for Brahmins, he immediately got off of his sitting place and offered his own seat to the Brahmana. And right before his own seat was the breaking of the fast meal. So he offered it to the Brahmana. Because he was a simple Brahmana, he only took half of what was on the king's plate and thanked the king and went on his way. So after cleaning everything, after the brahmana had gone, the king sat down to eat the remaining half, because it was, you know, a lot of opulent food. As he was about to complete the other half, one villager came with all his dogs. And said, "My dogs are very hungry. Can I give them something?" He's the king, about to break his fast, but because he's King Yantideva, and he's seeing all living entities equally, and they're very hungry, he gave the other half to the village man with all of his dogs, and his dogs ate up what was left. It's 48 days fasting. He's the king. But there was some water left. So he was about to take the water. And one mendicant came and said, "I'm very thirsty, parched throat, can I have some water?" So King Yantideva gave the water. And those three personalities, the brahmana, the villager, and the mendicant, then transformed themselves into the demigods who they actually were, had manifested themselves just to examine the renunciation of Yantideva. And they glorified him. Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, I think Indra. This is described in the Bhagavatam. When the thirsty man came from the water, Yantideva offered a few prayers to the Supreme Lord, expressing how grateful he was to be engaged in service of his part and parcel living entities in various positions. As the given the opportunity to serve them, he was very happy. And the demigods, when they disclosed their identity, they expressed how happy they were with King Yantideva. And the expression was, because of one's renunciation of the enjoyments of this world, one's mind can then be peaceful. And when one's mind is peaceful, then one can contemplate the Supreme, which is what's being said in chapter 12. Once the value of renouncing the fruits of one's work, besides it frees one from the karma of the bondage of attachment to the fruits of work, it makes one's mind peaceful. In a peaceful condition of mind, one can then go to the next stage, not just working for Krishna, but following the regulations of bhakti, so that the desire to achieve Krishna's eternal abode becomes very prominent. And it's not an escapism desire to achieve Krishna's association. It's a transcendental, loving desire. So that's the end of the section. I'm just going to do a little review and we're done. Starting at the bottom, there's indirect processes. Then above that, there's direct, more direct, and then perfection. The indirect processes include meditation and cultivation of knowledge. Through meditation and cultivation of knowledge, there's some benefits. One's theoretical understanding of what's what's matter, what is spirit, what is to be done, what is not to be done, that's put in place. And to some degree, some control of the senses and of the mind, at least in a preliminary way, by processes of meditation and knowledge. Better than that is detachment from the fruits of work, because from that detachment from the fruits of work, one's mind can become more peaceful. And in that more peaceful state of mind, one can more deeply contemplate what is eternal. That which is of enduring value becomes clearer. most likely to share this experience of this past weekend. A group of about 80 of us went into the Canadian Rockies, into a farm I've never been to before, an ISKCON farm called Sharanagati. It's beautiful. It's about 1,500 acres in a valley. So on all sides are these big rocky mountains, and on the north side and the south side is, you know, where the channel of the valley comes, and it opens up, and there's this lake in the middle, and then it kind of narrows again, and the mountain range closes, and that's the farm. And it's the first thought when I got there is, wow, this is really quiet. And then, okay, no electricity. I didn't realize how dependent I am upon the little gadgets that are to use electricity. You can't charge your laptop and can't charge your cell phone. And anyway, it's just, it's different. You can't turn on a light switch. Because it was mountain range, there was water coming down the mountain, just a natural stream, and so there was running water. But otherwise, you have to pump the water, and there's no electricity, so you wouldn't have running water. You have to go to the well and pull the water. And it was very nice. It took some adjusting, but after adjusting, it's the whole atmosphere, besides what you don't have to put your mind into, the whole atmosphere is very peaceful. When the mind is very peaceful, you can contemplate. In fact, when I was a young boy, I grew up on a lake. Very close to a lake. One of the Finger Lakes in New York State. Those of you that know your geography of New York, it's right in the middle of the state. There's five, and they're like the fingers. So it was this one, or this one. It's a 17-mile-long lake, and the water is so pure that the whole city of Syracuse just runs pipes into the lake and drinks it straight without treating it. It's very pure. No algae or E. coli bacteria or nothing like that. Just they drink it right straight, the whole city of Syracuse. And because I grew up by the lake, I spent a lot of time doing water sports and sailing and swimming and all that stuff. So when there's a storm, then all the whatever the particles that are at the bottom of the water, they get churned. So you can't see very deep into the water. But when it hasn't been a storm, you can see 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet into the, you know, there's a golf ball, some object. You can see it clearly. So a mind that's peaceful is like that. Well, then is the soul. The mind is turbulent. There's no question of contemplating the soul, contemplating eternal. But if the mind is peaceful, then you can contemplate very easily that which is eternal, the most meaningful things of life. So what prevents us to contemplate those things is passion. Furtive, chasing those little carrots. The fruit of goals of life. And you're in the workplace, they train you up. You gotta have a project deadline. You got that carrot out there and you go chasing after it. And everyone gets focused on achieving that goal. All the whole team, the whole company has gotta get that goal, that deadline. And you got several of them going on at the same time, depending on the companies. Or if it's not in the company before that, in education, you got your something-something exam, and you got your paper, and you got your thesis, or whatever it is. It's the way of life. in our modern culture. Goal-oriented. And it's not that transcendentalists are aimless, but we don't have fruitive goals, we have transcendental goals. The mind becomes fixed on achieving the lotus feet of Krishna. And everything else in life is centered around that, including the goals. The worldly things become spiritualized by dint of Krishna consciousness. We accept those things, anukojyasya sankalpa pratikoyasya varjana. We accept those things insofar as they're valuable to achieve bhakti. We reject those things that are not valuable to achieve bhakti. That's the, you know, the one and the zero. The binary processor goes for those things that, so if there are things that help us become attracted to Krishna, we accept them. So here are some things that help us come to that position. If we can't have our minds always fixed, so we'll go back up. There's the preliminary things, indirect things, knowledge and meditation, detachment from the fruits of work, working for Krishna, following the regulations of bhakti, so that one can achieve that stage of perfection, of attraction, of wanting to reside and be with Krishna eternally. Because one thing in life is for sure, and that's we're going to leave it. We're going to leave this place. Leave the body and go on somewhere else. There's this, I think, British saying, there's two things in life that are certain, death and taxes. So, death is for certain. That's Krishna confirms in Bhagavad Gita. So whatever it is that we accumulate, we're going to have to give it up. That's certain. So then, fix our attention on sat. And the regulations of bhakti help us fix our minds upon the person. As Krishna describes in the beginning of this chapter, that's the better form of worship. By all means, become a yogi and fix your mind upon the person. And the regulations of bhakti help you fix your mind upon the person. And the study of Bhagavad Gita helps you understand the whole system, how it works. So I'm sure there's regular classes and discussion on the topics of Bhagavad Gita. So I encourage you to take part in those discussions and together discuss and try to understand the message and then apply the message in your day-to-day life. So that at some of those entry levels, whichever it is that, yes, I feel I can do this, and that will help you achieve the next and the next up to the stage of perfection. Mind always fixed upon Krishna, intelligence always engaged in serving Him. We're using our intelligence and our minds anyways. So if the intelligence says, this should be done for Krishna's service, or you're eating, or you're bathing, or you're shopping, or the things of life. Go down, do them for Krishna. Follow the regulations of bhakti and do them for Krishna. Awaken the desire to always be thinking of Krishna and always engaging intelligence in some way to apply to serving Him. And that way, you'll
always live in Krishna.
He'll bring you to Him. He's the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. Any questions or comments? Anybody? Okay, we'll have RT. Thank you very much.
See the Prabhupada key? Yeah.